Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday. It's the first day of spring. It's March 20th. We've got currently 25 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 28 degrees in the Heber Valley, and mostly cloudy skies. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, we've got mostly cloudy skies out there. Welcome to the first official day of spring. Of course, today is the spring equinox. If you happen to be sleeping, it, of course, officially arrived at 3:01 this morning, in case you didn't notice it, which you probably didn't because you were probably sleeping. But hey, it doesn't bring any major impacts to us in terms of what you feel or see. But what you did notice here as we go throughout today is, of course, spring officially arriving. Those clouds helping it feel a little warmer outside this morning, with temperatures about 10 to 15 degrees warmer than where they were yesterday morning to start. But it's not because of just being spring. It's because of the clouds that helped to act like a blanket at night to help hold our temperatures up. As we go throughout the rest of today, we'll stick with the cloud cover, and we may see a couple of passing snow showers in the Park City area this afternoon. Not looking at a high chance, but there is at least a chance of a few snow showers and maybe an isolated snow shower as you get into the Heber Valley as well. High temperatures in Park City will only be in the upper 30s to around 40 degrees this afternoon, with highs in the mid-40s there in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your forecast for tonight, we drop back down into the upper teens to right around 20 degrees in both Park City and the Heber Valley. As we go throughout the day, we're looking at highs climbing near 40 degrees in Park City, highs in the mid to upper 40s in the Heber Valley with partly to mostly cloudy skies. And as we get into the weekend, we'll see one more quick moving storm system moving our way. That arrives on your Saturday. That'll bring us a chance of scattered snow showers, both in Park City and the Heber Valley. Now, this system may have a little bit more moisture to work with. It still doesn't look like a strong system, but it could be one that could bring maybe, you know, 1 to 4 inches of snow to the Park City area and maybe picking up an inch or two in the Heber Valley there with this system. Again, that would be on Saturday. So we're looking at a weak system, which just a few passing snow showers today, a slightly stronger one on Saturday that could bring us some light accumulations. Otherwise, that's going to be pretty much about it when it comes to precipitation over the next several days. That Saturday will feature low temperatures starting off around the freezing mark with highs only in the 40s. And then we start to warm it up big time heading into next week. So Sunday, we'll see the beginnings of that warming trend with highs back in the low to mid 40s in Park City and highs around 50 in the Heber Valley. And then by Monday, we're talking highs around 50 in Park City with highs nearing 60 in the Heber Valley. And by Tuesday, we're talking about those temperatures again nearing 60, even in Park City with highs in the mid to upper 60s on your Tuesday there for the Heber Valley. And by the time we get towards Wednesday, get ready for beautiful spring-like weather. Lots of sunshine. We're looking at lows in the mid-30s and highs in the low 60s for Park City and highs upper 60s to right around 70 for the Heber Valley. So we've got a little bit more of a taste of winter the next few days, Leslie, but then spring is really going to spring around here heading into next week.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And taking a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, it's Trent. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the wind picked up last night around midnight and continues to blow from the southwest this morning. Along the Park City ridgeline, I'm seeing speeds of 10 to 30 miles per hour gusting into the 30s and 40s. And you know, up there at 11,000 feet, you know, which is basically the top of Snowbird, the wind is blowing 41 gusting 68. Unfortunately, the wind will likely ruin the powder party up in the exposed terrain, you know, where the wind can affect that snow. Yeah, you just heard the weather today, a little cold front pushing through today, maybe a trace to a couple inches of snow up there in the mountains. This past recent storm left behind roughly 15 to 30 inches of new snow in the Wasatch Range, and today you'll continue to find good riding and turning conditions on most slopes that have a northerly tilt to them, so meaning a little. It was a beautiful day in the backcountry, sunshine, warming temperatures, and that definitely left a crust on most of the sunlit slopes and then low elevation slopes as well. Really, our biggest concern today is going to be wind-drifted snow, and that's because these prefrontal southerly winds have created a fresh batch of wind-drifted snow. These drifts could be soft or hard, and they could be 1 to 3 feet deep and large enough to catch and carry humans. Soft wind slabs are often pillowy and rounded looking, while hard wind slabs are, they sound hollow like a drum, and typically those will break around you. So if you're getting out in the backcountry today, be on the lookout and avoid slopes loaded by the wind. And in summary, we do have areas of moderate avalanche danger that exists on all upper elevation slopes and on mid-elevation slopes facing northwest through east for wind-drifted snow avalanches. In either case, look for soft or hard slabs of wind-drifted snow. You out of the wind, you're going to find an overall low avalanche danger. And just a real quick hot tip is that you can significantly reduce your risk of an avalanche today by avoiding the wind-loaded part of any slope. So, you know, if you are gonna get out there and ride, if you're seeing wind drifting into the slope, slip in below it or from the side and leave that wind-loaded area alone. And just make sure there's no wind slab before committing to steep terrain. Outside of that wind problem, we generally have a stable snowpack.
Okay, stay safe out there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a Summit County attorney says council members have a creative option to promote affordable housing, designate an all-affordable zone for developers. KPCW's Connor Thomas has details on that.
In Utah's richest county, Summit County council members sometimes express frustration at their options to making housing affordable and attainable. Council Chair Tanya Hansen.
How do we get affordable housing without all the other developments? Right? It's the only way to do that is for the county to build affordable housing, or is there any other critical path to get there?
In Western Summit County, developers are required to make 20% of their residential units affordable, meaning reserved for people making less than 80% of the county's median income. Or they can bypass that requirement by paying a fee, which county planners think is set too low. But the Utah legislature made the county's policy called inclusionary zoning illegal in 2022. The county's policy is grandfathered into that law, but its requirements and fee are not allowed to change. Park City's in the same boat. Since then, county council members' primary path toward affordable housing has been negotiating development agreements, as they did with Dakota Pacific Real Estate. The topic came up during the council's housing policy discussion March 12th. During the debate, Deputy Civil Attorney Dave Thomas said there's a third option.
Affordable housing you can make a profit on, and there are various companies that do that as their model. You could form a zone district that is simply an affordable housing zone district.
Assuming there's profit to be had, landowners may be incentivized to apply for the affordable housing zone.
Because they're rezoning it to it, the prohibitions on inclusionary zoning don't come into play.
They set a goal March 12th to approve 1,500 affordable housing units within the next decade, but they haven't decided when, where, or how to make it happen. Summit County and Park City Municipal are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Summit County Council met yesterday, and in the studio with a meeting recap, I have Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, let's start with that affordable zone conversation. Basically, this would then allow Summit County to not have to deal with the fee in lieu of or that 20% inclusionary zoning if you have a zone all to itself?
Yeah, apparently if we create a zone that would be targeted at affordable housing, you know, let's say that we create a zone that a developer could seek to rezone an area to, that would require that any residential properties in that zone comply with certain AMI requirements, that it all be affordable and certain AMI requirements. Then we're not requiring, the inclusionary zoning is if you want to build 500 units, 20% of those must be affordable. That's the, or a fee in lieu, and I think we've tried to get rid of that fee in lieu. It wasn't as helpful as we had hoped. This just makes it a zone that's for affordable housing specifically. So it's not dealing with if you build a certain number of units, some portion of them must be. We're saying this is an affordable housing zone. This is where we've decided to put affordable housing. And again, it was just a, it was a broad topic of a conversation. It was something Dave brought up, Dave Thomas from the county attorney's office, brought up to say, well, you know, this is one option that you could do, just create a zone for affordable.
But that really goes against what the county has done in the past. I remember the long, drawn-out discussions at Snyderville Basin Planning Commission level when we talked about Silver Creek Village, talk about the discovery, and it was like it was very important to council at that point to have these affordable units integrated within a community. So you couldn't go, oh, there's the affordable housing, there's the market rate housing. This changes that.
Well, it doesn't change it because we haven't adopted it yet. And that's kind of, that was one of the topics that we brought up, because for Silver Creek Village, that was back when Canis was still on the Planning Commission, I think. And the Planning Commission was really wrestling with the notion of what is integration, because the housing, the affordable elements have to be integrated within the overall development so that you don't see that. And we ultimately resolved it in terms of what we want to see as best we could with a term, you know, that attempts to define something. But when I took Casey Snyder, Representative Snyder, on a tour of our affordable housing a year and a half ago, driving through Silver Creek Village, you can't tell. And it's remarkable. And I think that is still important. At the same time, if we feel like we've got issues with affordable housing, my concern is to get affordable housing under our current system. And this housing discussion was the most intensive discussion of affordable housing, the who, what, when, where, that we've had. And it's something I've been asking for a couple of years. It was wonderful. It was full ranging. Typically, we're reactive to developers. We're reacting to their proposal rather than seeking to try and achieve something. Now we've set a goal that we want to try and achieve. And secondarily, typically for us to get affordable housing, we have to swallow a large amount of market rate housing. Market rate housing generates the need for more affordable, and it just becomes a cycle that we can't break. So finding a way, to Dave's point, to overcome that we can't afford to build affordable, well, let's find out if they can. Let's see if we can create a zone.
Okay, you call it a cycle. I call it a hole that just gets deeper.
I totally agree.
All right, got to move on because I got a lot to cover here this morning. High Valley Transit, the council discussed increasing the size of the High Valley Transit Board yesterday. During that discussion, you criticized members of the Park City Council for what you said, name-calling and disparaging Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez. Specifically, what do you take issue with here?
Well, I take issue with, you know, it seems like every Park City Council meeting, they come up with something in council comments. One council person in particular that wants to poke at High Valley Transit. High Valley Transit, if you think about the leadership that we have at High Valley Transit, which is Kim Carson as chair of the board, Caroline Rodriguez, who has done amazing things in this county for transportation since she came here a decade ago, David Geffen, who is one of the smartest guys I've worked with, Chris Robinson, Canis, and now Megan, they've done amazing things. If you look at the transit system that we've put together, ironically on this subject, this comes out of BRT, and Diane Foster came to me, this is truly ironic, came to me in 2013-14, and she said, BRT has got to be our solution down 224. City manager for Park City. And my response was, I hate BRT. It doesn't work anywhere. And the reason I hate BRT is, unless you're grade separated, it can't work. This BRT is planned to have some sort of signal priority, so that's the equivalent of grade separation, because you're not stuck in left turn lanes, et cetera. So it's been said that leadership at High Valley Transit is gaslighting the public, because Caroline Rodriguez wrote an informative piece for the public, for the Park Record, about BRT and why we're pursuing it. This is a process that's been a collaborative process from day one with Park City and UDOT for 12 plus years to get to this point. We have tens of millions of dollars allocated to BRT at this point. We're at an inflection point with the federal government where funding is at risk across the board. Federal funding is at risk. And now we're in a similar position that we were in with Park City in the discussions over 248, where UDOT is poised and ready to go with this project. And we're arguing over whether a 5-foot expansion of 224 within Park City on one side and 5 feet on the other side is somehow going to destroy the entire character of Park City, and that High Valley Transit's leadership is gaslighting the information to the public. It's nonsensical.
Were you part of Tuesday's discussion with UDON?
I was not.
Okay, so we don't know really what happened there. Does you say there's a real threat to federal funding if we do change the drawings of the plans?
This plan has been put together for years. It's part of the Olympics plan. I mean, it carries all the way through. This design has been in place. It's been discussed with Park City. Park City staff has been at the table. And it's just frustrating now at this point. We've got a couple of new council members who want to understand the value of BRT and that short section. You defeat the purpose of BRT, which is to try and get as many people out of cars and into buses to avoid the traffic problems that we have. It's not a magic bullet. It's not going to entirely fix traffic, but it's a good lift. If you tell people to get on BRT at Kemble Junction, if we have a capture parking lot there, get on BRT at Kemble Junction, and then you have to get off at the canyons and wait for the next bus to connect through, that's not BRT. That's a problem. And trying to explain value to somebody in that regard, it's lost on me. I don't even understand what the concerns are at this point.
So when do you have to make a decision?
Now. I mean, Caroline asked for a decision when we had, not the last joint meeting, which was Friday, but the meeting before. She said, I need a decision today. Are you going to go forward? And I think we got a soft yes, but we seem to still be circling the same drain. And it seems to be the same two or three voices that want more information. So HVT, I understand, spent $22,000 last month to provide more data, to cook up, to derive more information to provide to Park City. And it's still not answering whatever the ephemeral question is that I don't understand. And what I'm not going to stand for is this overt criticism of Caroline Rodriguez. She is a huge linchpin. She's created our relationship with Wasatch County. And if somebody starts attacking staff for doing their job, they've got a problem with me.
So who are these two to three voices that you're talking about so we can reach out to them?
I would rather not start calling out names on air.
Hmm. Let's see. When do they move into?
You can listen to council meetings, and it'll become fairly apparent quickly.
All right. Legislative recap. You got a recap of this session from Jana Young, deputy county manager, and your lobbying team from Foxley and Pignatelli. Apart from House Bill 356, the county redistricting bill, the legislative team did report success. Let's talk about that 356, which requires districted elections. Some county officials are expressing a sense of betrayal. How do you feel about that?
I think that's exactly right. This thing came up, actually, I first heard about it from somebody who was running for the state legislature when Kara Berkland stepped down. And he said that he was positive he was going to win this seat, and he was having conversations with people in the legislature. This bill was coming up, and he was going to support it and felt that it was important. He's since written a couple of articles about it in the Park Record. We met with the bill sponsor, county council members, county staff, our lobbyists, and talked to them about trying to get the bill pulled. And if not pulled, at least softened, because the way it's drafted right now, or the way it was originally drafted, all five council members would have timed out December 31, 2026. We all would have had to have stood for re-election in January, even if we were just re-elected last November. That was pulled so we can serve out our terms, but once the districts are drawn, we're assigned by lot to various districts, so I could wind up representing North Summit, which is odd, and seems a very random way to do this. Also, there's very little input into the drawing of the districts by the most populous part of the county. It's five mayors on the east side, mayor of Park City plus one unincorporated at-large resident.
Yeah, we've worked really hard to kind of build relationships with the state legislature, but when you see something like this, I mean, what does that tell you?
Well, I think this was tailor-made. You know, periodically we get requests from certain people on the east side to consider creating a district specifically for Eastern Summit County. The public, when they went to the council manager form of government, was given the option of having districts, and they said, no, thank you. And we've resisted that, but we've also made sure that we always have somebody from Eastern Summit County, David Ewer, Tal Adair, Doug Clyde, Tanya now, somebody from Eastern Summit County has always been on board. Kim Carson and I think, really started a move to do outreach to Eastern Summit County. We constantly, even it's continued all the way through the current council, we're constantly checking in with the mayors. We have a great relationship in COG. Chris Robinson is a resident of Old Ranch Road, but Chris has significant land holdings in Eastern Summit County, so he's aware of the issues. So it's not like they've been unrepresented. They have had a voice. We made sure that they had a voice through their leadership. And it's really frustrating for somebody to do this. And it came up, it was literally passed at 11:57 on the last night.
Wasatch County's asked for the governor to veto it. Do you think the Hinkie will?
I don't know the answer to that.
Just in our last couple of minutes here, I want to mention about the 910 Ranch. So we heard that, I mean, it's been delayed. What if the federal money doesn't come through? What's plan B?
Let's just hope the federal money comes through. I mean, there would be a plan B. We'll continue to look for grants, and we've got the money that, if we had to, I think we could probably pay for it. I think we're still trying to find alternative ways to do that.
All right. And then the East Side and West Side Planning Commission appointments, two to each side. We have now on the Centerville Basin Planning Commission, these are the third and fourth new appointees in just a few months. So is that concerning, all of this turnover?
It concerns me. I mean, the turnover is not, you know, for any nefarious reasons. I don't think it's because planning commissioners are tired. I think, you know, we've had various personal issues that have played into it. I am concerned. I think that, you know, experience on that is arguably, without demeaning or taking away from any other board or commission that we have, from a growth and a zoning standpoint, those are the most important commissions that we have. And they're often the grooming grounds for county council and stepping up into additional leadership. So they have a lot of work to do. Wrestling with some of the stuff that the legislature hands down has to be frustrating. Wrestling with some of the changes that the county council makes after somebody makes a decision has to be equally frustrating. But we still need really good, smart people. And I think the appointments that we made fit that category. They'll be great.
Okay, Roger, I got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
That's Summit County Council member Roger Armstrong. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Board of Education met Tuesday in the studio with a recap. I have the superintendent of schools, Lindsay Huntsman, along with school board member Nick Hill. Thanks so much for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The board approved the design of part of the athletics master plan. We've got fields, facilities at a cost of about $38 million. That's going to be paid for, my understanding is, with lease revenue bonds. So when do those get released?
Yeah, the board voted last fall to release that $38 million in revenue bonds to be paid back in 20 years for the athletic facilities. And as you saw in the presentation, the conceptual design options were cost neutral. We presented two designs to the board, and the board ultimately voted to move forward with option two.
Okay. Does that mean that Dozier Field gets moved or it stays put?
It stays in its current place.
Yeah. Okay, so those bonds have been released? I mean, you have money in the bank, or do we wait till we get closer to construction, or just not knowing what's going to happen? You got a better interest rate now, or how do you figure that out?
I don't have the exact date in front of me. I don't want to misspeak, but I believe the bonds will be released in the next month or so, which will align with when we can actually start work.
All right. And as you mentioned, Lindsay, business administrator Randy Upton says that he believes he can still do this without a tax increase. But of course, during the retreat, you had heard that we're looking at a $4 million deficit. So has that been cleared up? And this is still going to go forward as kind of a no tax increase plan?
Yes. Yeah, so we continue to look at ways in which we can move forward with minimal tax increase. But our ultimate goal is no tax increase. And the way in which we've been able to do that is as people have decided to pursue other opportunities or retire, we are analyzing those positions and determining whether or not we do in fact need those. And that has been happening since the fall as part of realignment work with Treasure Mountain being decommissioned as a school and moving eighth grade to Ecker and ninth grade into Park City High School.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the concern from some residents along Lucky John Drive with option number two. What does that mean that they're going to see across the street from them?
Yeah, so the there is going to be a structure on that north end of the field. We feel we can mitigate much of the impact and actually help them a little bit with noise mitigation through landscaping, moving soils, and just generally constructing a barrier there that is going to be probably better to look at than what they see right now.
So there is an access from Lucky John Drive to Dozier Field. Does that get taken away? You know, there's also that drop-off area.
That access will stay there. That's used for, you know, emergency vehicles and things. That will stay there. There is no plan to use that as, you know, additional ingress egress for the site.
All right, unless there's permission then from the church there on the corner, because a lot of graduation parking happens there, right, with access to, and that would just be special conditional uses then.
Sure.
Yeah, and I would encourage any residents to take a look at the design. It's a sloped roof, which is different from existing buildings. Much like Nick said, the building shape will dampen sound, and the construction workers as well as our architect is working to ensure that it is aesthetically pleasing and their landscaping will match what exists.
Okay, so with those concessions on the second floor, people are going to have to carry their hamburgers and hot dogs and drinks downstairs? Is that what's going to be built? I mean, why not just do it at grade level?
I think, you know, we're looking at the field level for locker rooms, team facilities, those kind of things. There is a cost benefit in keeping it in one structure. It is a decision where you put each piece of that within that structure. But certainly there's a path around the field that will remain there. I honestly haven't looked at exactly the detail of how it will meet up with that path, but it will remain ADA compliant. And I think it is going to be a good solution for everyone.
So. Okay. You also received some information about the proposed budget, and you kind of briefly alluded to Lindsay, that business administrator Randy Upton doesn't think a tax increase will be necessary, except for the staff, because we're on that third year of a tax increase?
Correct. So next year will be the third year of the compensation agreement where all employees receive that 6% increase. But we will continue to work towards minimizing a tax increase, with the goal being no tax increase. And I feel confident we're going to get there. We're only in March, and we have until June to adopt a budget.
Right. I feel confident as well. I have very deep confidence in the superintendent and in the business administrator, Randy. It is our goal to avoid any tax increases. When those pay increases were approved, there was an expectation that a tax increase would be needed to cover those, but we are keen to avoid that.
Yeah, news just this morning that President Trump will be signing an executive order to dismantle the Federal Department of Education, and certainly there's some pushback on this because it requires congressional approval to do that, but already we have seen the department workforce cut in half. Given the billions of dollars that the federal government provides for low-income students and specially needs students, do we have any idea at this point how that might impact us?
Yeah, again, we're waiting patiently to see how this might impact us. I've read a bit as to what this might do and what it might mean for us, and I do believe some of that funding will remain intact, even though there will likely be a dismantling of the Department of Education at the federal level.
And obviously we do get funding from the federal level, but the amount of funding we get is relatively small. So it would be hard to avoid any impact from something like that, but the extent of the impact we think would be relatively minimal to us.
Okay, so any shortfalls though would need to be picked up by local taxpayers,
yes.
Yeah, maybe the state, right? That's what we'd be looking to, right, from their funding?
It would be lovely to think that the state would pick up that shortfall.
What's the latest on the Office of Civil Rights Investigations? Again, with federal layoffs happening there, I mean, I had seen a story a month ago just basically saying that, you know, investigations are at a standstill. I mean, what do you tell the 88 families that, well, nothing's happening here?
Yeah, I think regardless of what happens at the federal level, we're committed to not only addressing what we've agreed to in the OCR resolution and the settlement, but we're also going to go above and beyond to ensure all of our students are entering a school environment free of hate speech, harassment, and discrimination.
Yeah, because so much of that had to do with many of the investigations underway with gender, DEI, LGBTQ, right? And then just bullying as a result of that. With all of that kind of now off the playing field, any fear, though, that it's just like, well, these don't matter anymore?
Absolutely not. We're going to keep the protections for our students in place. The deans will remain in place. And as Maya Angelou once said, you know, when you know better, you do better. And we will continue to do better and get better as an organization in terms of how we respond to discrimination, harassment, and hate speech.
All right. And I also just received, and this was just late last night, so I didn't kind of give you a heads up that I wanted to talk about it, but received information about what the school district paid in to look into the alleged defamation claims made in a November Park Record article by a freelance reporter, Michelle Deininger. These documents show that the school district paid more than $11,000 for that legal research. I haven't seen anything from the paper retracting or correcting that report. We had heard from former board president that, you know, it was full of mistruth. So can we put this to rest? I mean, our defamation charges upcoming, because we certainly haven't seen what our $11,000 have paid for.
They are not. I'm not going to get into the specifics of the conversations that we as a board had in closed session around that. What I will say is that, as I said, I think last time I was here, the basis for that story was public information.
So right now, the district stands by. And I mean, should we expect more legal action on this?
There is not going to be further legal action.
It's done. The report stands.
From our perspective, it is done.
All right.
I will just say that further to that, there was one aspect of the articles relating to pay, and we very deliberately went through the pay schedule and how the increases we made a couple of years ago impacted the pay throughout the district. And I do think it is important to note that all pay in the district is in line with our pay schedule. You know, we think it's really time to recognize that, you know, there's no suggestion of anyone being paid outside of that pay schedule. And so, you know, as far as there is a debate over what people are paid, that really needs to be had with us as a board over that pay schedule, which is public. Beyond that, you know, it is time from our perspective to move on.
Real quick, what's the status then of Mike Tanner? There's been some social media reports that he's been placed on administrative leave.
At this time, we won't comment. What I can say is we are planning to issue a statement likely next week or the following week.
And at some point, there were two investigations happening. The Attorney General apparently has let the district and Summit County Sheriff and Park City Police know that he's not going to be following up on any criminal charges at the same time.
That's correct.
That's correct. Yes. Okay. The district at the same time was doing an internal investigation. So where does that stand?
There are no active investigations at this time.
Okay. And just wait until next week. Is that
correct?
What you're telling me? All right. Let's move on to the student on the school shared survey results from Park City High School students on how they feel about the cell phone policies.
Yeah, it's a shocker. The students don't want restrictions on their cell phones. Yeah.
Well, can you give us some specifics on that?
If you followed the legislative session, there was a bill passed, and we already have a cell phone policy, but we need to tighten that up and actually implement it with fidelity. So what is happening at Treasure, you know, the Yonder Pouch, it has yielded very positive results, but we also recognize what is happening in eighth grade and ninth grade might need to be different with 10th, 11th, and 12th grade? Because now you're talking about students who have cars. They have the ability to leave campus. There's a safety concern. So we are taking that into consideration as we consider how do we evolve our policy to actually make sure it's being implemented.
And I will just add, so the student feedback, I think, was interesting because obviously there was that perspective of, you know, we don't want restrictions on cell phones. But there was also a suggestion, a very reasonable suggestion, of how a policy can be implemented, which was to, you know, effectively take attendance through through cell phones being given up at the door when they go into class, right? And I think our student body is smart, and you know, they not only said, you know, we don't want overly burdensome restrictions, but they also said, here is a system that we think will really work.
All right. I had some numbers thrown at me. 81% of students don't want the policy. 85% of staff and parents do want the policy. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay.
Hey, we know that students and adults thrive with structure, right? And we need to be clear and just establish that structure and ensure that it's age appropriate.
All right. Anything else you two wanted to mention?
Yeah, I'll give an update on many of the administrative announcements that took place on Tuesday. Obviously, Tracy Fike will be moving into the CTE director position come the fall, which means the Trailside principalship is now open. That position is posted, and we sent out a survey yesterday to the staff gathering input in terms of what they'd like to see in a future leader for their building. We will hold assistant principal interviews next Friday, March 28th. There are two vacancies at Park City High School and one at Ecker Hill Middle School. So again, trying to fast track this to ensure that these positions are filled. There's a seamless transition and those individuals can step into those roles feeling like we have set them up for success.
Okay, good work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Utah Legislature has wrapped its 45-day annual session, and on the phone with a recap of how this session went, I have State Representative Mike Kohler, who represents Wasatch County and a portion of Summit County, including Park City. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How's it going today?
Doing well, thanks. Of course, the budget is the legislature's number one job. The state didn't have the revenues it did last year, so we're looking for some cuts. So what do you see as the primary function of government?
Well, and when it applies to the budget, obviously we passed the first day just some base budgets to get all the functions of government on for one more year, and then we bring in what revenue we have or don't have and make adjustments at the end. And some of the adjustments we did obviously give a little bit because it's been a trend and it's been a goal to get our income tax cut back a little bit more each year, and we did that a little bit. We increased in education. We increased and put a little bit more in transportation, which is obviously an increasing demand. There's been a little bit more emphasis on that because of the Olympics. I'm assuming that. And there were also a lot of things that we allowed, when I say allowed, that were permitted in downtown Salt Lake and other places having to do with the increment taxes to build public infrastructure for certain venues that are coming. So when it comes to my personal thing, obviously we have education. We have our regular things that we pay for and keep our transportation routes running, social services, and et cetera. But basically, we came through trying to maintain everything we were doing and allow for a little bit of cutback because we were actually about $100 million short.
Yeah. You know, I've always heard the responsibility of government is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people it serves. And, you know, we talked about this kind of going into the session about this income tax break. Again, I mean, at my income level, you guys saved me all of about $13. That's a couple of burritos at the 7-Eleven. Utah's richest residents, however, will see a much larger tax break. And I guess why, again, I just don't understand. Why do we give those breaks to those who can best afford to pay taxes, while then now we're going to see some areas, especially in the social services, struggle from the increasing inflation and the resources that can help them? Why do those get cut?
Well, some couple of things. It becomes a philosophical thing for sure, and I'm not on the general appropriations. I was on ag appropriations and went through that part and some of the adjustments that were made in the total budget. When those were made, I was not part and haven't heard a lot about the discussion. But that, philosophically, you're correct. If we took the whole state budget and put in social services, there wouldn't be enough. So each year, those are – and some of them aren't quite traumatizing as you listen to the discussion about where our social services money goes. we try to hit the do the most or the best. Now, when you get specifically for income tax, virtually all of the best growing and maintained states have either little or no income tax. That's not 100% true, but most of them do. And so since I've been in, and even before I was a legislator, there has been an effort to slowly cut the income tax back to match what other states are doing that are growing. And each time that happens, we have to find another offset or something that else does it or cut the service. And yeah, this isn't a big one. I think it's $4 or $5 for me. You are correct in that most of the rich people are going to get the most because they pay it all. Most, probably 50% of our state doesn't pay any income tax or pays very, very little. So that said, that is not the, the target is to try and get the income tax down further than it is. And I think you'll see a small incremental decrease each year, depending on where the economy goes and allows us to have that revenue option.
Okay. And then the seniors, you kind of took away that funding for the property tax benefits to put it, you know, I know that Summit and Wasatch County both pay that. So that's kind of gone away.
Well, there's going to be, you're going to see a couple of things on senior and with property taxes. We changed the circuit breaker a little bit. We set it up so that there are going to be options for not paying your taxes, like kind of a Prop 13 in California, similar to that. I'm not necessarily enthused about and support all the time a reverse mortgage type event that is triggered when the person either leaves the house or passes away and it's sold, because that just trades it off. Somebody else pays it in the meantime. But we did give some new programs and additional strength to some programs for seniors that can't pay, or you have to be a certain income, obviously, and then our servicemen have their options as well. That said, we're far from done there. We've taken a shot at it the last 2 years. We had a couple of bills that didn't pass this year that are going to be even stronger. But we've got to do something before we take a payer group out, and seniors are a big hit because I'm actually in that group now where I'm in a position where a lot of those people are, where you're retired, don't have a lot of income options, and their taxes are going astronomically higher because supposedly the houses have value that are higher than they've been. And we're trying to work that in and make it reasonable. We're far from done, but we did make a couple of steps this time that hopefully make it better. Okay. We also took a shot at Social Security, which is in that same category.
Yeah, right. That didn't happen either. So lawmakers gave teachers a $1,400 raise, but took away their union's ability to negotiate future salaries and benefits. And the raise feels a little bit, I think, to teachers like a consolation prize. House Bill 267, which bans unions from collective bargaining by public sector employees, only won by 10 votes. That feels retaliatory, I think, to teachers. You voted against that. Why?
Well, I was against the original one. We were talking. There was a group in the House side when it went. That's where it went through first. That were working on a compromise that would have allowed some other options for discussion, especially for the younger teachers, and mostly for firemen. In hindsight, it went through the Senate side. They apparently proposed most of those changes. The UE and the NEA and the firemen opposed it, so they just passed it. In hindsight, again, I probably would have liked to support it for two reasons. Number one, I talked to our superintendent in Wasatch County, and collective bargaining does very little over here. I realize that some of the bigger districts do, but the state gets their funding, and it basically goes out, and a lot of it's hand-to-hand, and meaning talking to the teachers individually and groups, and inference was that they don't do a lot here. That also said, the reason the bill came up at all is because of, so, and what I would perceive to say is some of the abuse of it in some of the larger school districts where there's a lot more problems than there are in the smaller ones, even in some in Wasatch County, which we can't say we're small anymore, but we are comparatively, where they just had a lot of pushback, firemen as well. I don't think this is the end of it. I would hope that we can come up with a plan next year as this develops. Now, obviously, there's a referendum being proposed and other things, but there needs to be a different system. I don't support the NEA. I support it very little because of what they push on us. Mm-hmm. UEA is a little better, but not much. And I just think there's got to be another thing, another different type of organization put together where they talk and help the teachers, but don't get into the philosophical or the shall we say, the teaching methods and what we teach and all that, get out of that and just work for the teachers and what they get and what they can do more directly. And I believe that was the target. I don't think the process is done.
House Bill 356, this too, an about face from what Summit County voters determined in 2006. It wanted and it voted for a 5-member Summit County Council without districts. House Bill 356, of course, the bill that affects both Summit and Wasatch County Councils, and it was sponsored by a representative who doesn't even live on the Wasatch back. You voted against it. Wasatch County has written a letter asking the governor to veto it, but was there anything you could have done to try and stop this? I mean, did you try and get up and explain to your colleagues that this is legislative overreach?
Well, I push for local control a lot. This came from a person down in the city, and he was trying to, I know that his intent was to try and clarify commissions that are, counties that are still under commissions and what they could and couldn't do. And also in the manager council form of governments that some of us have, Logan being probably the original target, as I understand it. When it came right down to it, in my opinion, I think it'd be good if Park City, Summit County had districts back in the days when it was being created. I talked a lot to the people that were organizing it, and I think it should have happened then. So I actually support the Summit County district process. That said, I had other bills that were I was working on that evening. When it went over to the Senate side, it would not have included Wasatch County. We were fine under the percentage. It got amended over there and brought back for concurrence. I wasn't even on the floor when it came back and didn't know about it till it was over because I was all working my other bills on the Senate side. So my preference would have been to leave it alone and let, you know, have Summit County go through the process where I think the end result would have been one at large and 4 districts under that percentage. When it went to 100, I would have the other option I think we needed is to give them more time. The intensity of which this turns over is too quick, in my opinion. So whether he vetoes it or not, I'm not sure what's going to happen there. It's down to where it basically just includes Wasatch and Summit counties with some other small changes. And haven't talked to anybody to see what's going on there, but we'll see what happens in the next couple of days.
And I got to say, I mean, this is the kind of legislation that gives the legislature a bad name. Doing something like this 3 minutes before midnight is nuts, especially when it's, you know, the parties that it affects doesn't even have a chance to say anything about it.
Yes, I totally agree. And, you know, that's a leadership thing, and it's a process thing that happens all the time. I've been there watching this process for 25 years, and the last 24 hours are just, they're heartbreaking in a sense, and they're just harrowing. You have to stay up with everything. And as a legislator, as a lobbyist, I had my focus on about 20 bills. Legislature, you got to be ready for whatever comes in front of you. And a lot of it's been changed in 10 minutes before. And I believe that my personal opinion is I support some rule changes that slow that down in the last day to give us more time. Unfortunately, that hasn't carried a lot of weight yet. I think there are a few that are still working on trying to make that change, and we'll do something, hopefully talk about it this summer.
Okay, just going to say,
these things always slip through. It just happens.
And I'm going to say, there ought to be a law. That's something that should be allowed. Okay. Hey, yeah. I've got a minute left here. I want to get to this. House Bill 540 is a bill that you and Senator Ron Winterton sponsored that would amend preliminary municipality law, basically amending Senate Bill 258 that was approved back in 2024. So what were you hoping this bill would do, prevent Dakota Pacific from being able to incorporate?
Actually, it wouldn't have helped anybody. It wouldn't have changed anybody that's already under an application. So Dakota Pacific would not have been approved unless they made some mistakes and had to reapply. But the basic thing is when this went through a year ago, similarly in the last minute, there was a process or somewhere down in Moab that this was specifically going for. It's bad policy. Wasatch County's been affected by it years ago, a similar bill that created towns under corporations. It's a bad policy, and I was hoping to get through. That's what I was pushing when the other bill went back the other way. I was over in the Senate trying to get it considered. It didn't pass. We're going to take another shot at that this year.
Okay. I'm so out of time right now, but I appreciate your time, State Representative Mike Kohler.
Thank you for your time.